We're going to call to order the meeting for the Senate Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development. Not bad today. March 19th, 2013. We're going to start with an overview. We're going to do this. Yes, an overview, an informational meeting, an overview of the National Organic Program Standards. There was a bill, SB 603, and that's kind of what got us to having this conversation. And so with that, we'll have a short explanation of that bill, even though we're really not, it's not really a testimony about the bill. And Senator Cruz, who was the other bill, can come up while we're doing that. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 603 directs the Oregon Department of Agriculture to propose a requirement for certification, sale, or labeling of agricultural products sold or labeled as organically produced that includes a prohibition against selling or labeling agricultural products containing detectable levels of artificially derived compounds as organically produced.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. This was kind of a constituent issue for me, but also an issue for me. For the record, I am a farmer. And also for the record, I have nothing against the use of chemicals. But it gets down to kind of, for me, it started out as a truth in advertising issue. And I know there are a lot of folks who are very strong on organic farming. In fact, there are even some who think that we ought to do just nothing but organic farming. And my question to them would be, at that point, which billion people on the planet do you want to starve to death if we went to pure organics? But that's a side issue from this. I would also point out that for example, a plant really doesn't care where its nitrogen comes from, whether it's a pellet of triple 16 or a chicken dropping. It's all the same to the plant, and you can't tell the difference. but I do know the beginning where I started with this bill was I said, let's just have some truth in advertising. If you're labeling something organic, it should be organic. If you're using chemicals, that should be noted. But that's not in what the standards are. The way it works is if there is not an organic something that can deal with a pest or a disease, you can be allowed to use chemicals. And my favorite example currently is the spotted wing Drosophilus. Mr. Chair, I'm sure you've heard of that. Mm-hmm. Okay. For those who don't know what that is, it's the new friendly little fruit fly that we have imported from China. And what is incredibly susceptible to the spotted wing Drosophilus is soft skin fruit, which would be berries, cherries, things like that. And here's the issue. If you don't do something to control that, all of your raspberries will have little larvae in them because they will lay the eggs. And really there is no organic way to deal with that, and probably most people use malathion or something similar to that to do it. And it's allowable, okay, simply because there is no alternative. Now, I do want to say that we use such products on my farm, and it can be done, and it can be done incredibly safely, and there is no trace of that chemical when you go to harvest, and which is really what the standard should be. However, you know, what I was looking at was if you're using chemicals, but you're labeling organic, the consumer ought to at least know that, and there is really no way to know that. So my original bill basically was going to say, in Oregon, if you're labeling something organic, it has to truly be organic. Well, now here's where it got interesting, because I was laboring under the assumption that all federal regs were basically the same. For example, when it comes to heavy metal standards set forth by EPA, the state of Oregon, DEQ, has heavy metal standards way above what the EPA requires. And in most cases, a state is allowed to go above the federal standard, but they can't go below it. And so that was kind of the premise I was operating on. Come to find out in the world of organics, it's kind of almost the opposite of that, is we cannot go above the federal standard without having to jump through a whole lot of hoops and waivers, and the department will explain this a little more. I mean, there is some wiggle room in there, but I just find it interesting. In the issue of organics, it's counterintuitive to everything else as the relationship between the feds and the state have. So I appreciate the chance to have this discussion. Quite simply, my only desire in this was for the people to know that if they're buying something that's labeled organic, assuming that no chemical has ever come near it, that isn't necessarily the case. It's not a knock on chemicals. Chemicals, if used appropriately, and most farmers do, are very beneficial. For example, if we did not spray our corn for cornworms, every one of our ears of corn would have cornworms. You know, we used to be kind of a joke on my farm is that here's how, you know, how you can tell the difference between a chemically treated apple and an organic apple. The organic apple has a worm in it.
More protein.
Huh?
More protein.
Unfortunately, what we've discovered is that even though an ear of corn with a cornworm in it, that is additional protein, most people don't seem to kind of take that approach to it. So, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to kind of vent a little bit myself here on an interesting standard. And by the way, I have done organic farming before, and it was kind of by accident, but we did. And I will say that the hoops you have to jump through to qualify as organic are relatively stringent, and they should be. But there are the exceptions, and I just don't think the public understands that there are exceptions. And I think, you know, it's truth in advertising, and really that's the whole point of this. So I want to thank you for the time, and I have had conversations with the department, and they will explain their process, and I think it's important people understand that.
Thank you. Any questions? I just had one because I was hoping this was going to be the bill that I like, because my wife and I have this conversation all the time about organic. I took organic chemistry in college, and I have a different definition of organic, and it drives me crazy that they stole this name and put it on food. And all of us are organic, and all the food we have is organic, and my organic chemists, you know, I don't know what they can do now. Do they have to use no chemicals in their chemistry?
No, Mr. Chair, I don't know. You know, one thing is over a decade ago, Fred Meyer tried a marketing campaign. Basically, they were doing tissue sampling on all of the produce they were selling, and they were labeling it as residue free, okay, because there was no chemicals in it whatsoever. Well, it turns out that wasn't a very good, very attractive marketing campaign, and so they abandoned it. But for farmers who use chemicals. Use them very sparingly and very appropriately as an economic driver. For one thing, you're not going to spend money that you don't have to spend. But you know, we raise 50 different crops on my farm, and we use herbicides and pesticides, and we use chemical fertilizer, and we use them appropriately by label instructions, and that includes how long after application you have to go before you can get in the field. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I'll tell you one more story. It's interesting because it's a matter of public perception. There's a comedy team called Penn and Teller, and they had a show on Showtime that had a title I can't say here. But they
sure
did.
You can.
Huh?
Go ahead.
No. Well, it was bull something. But anyway. They had one they did on organic farming, and my favorite part of that, because they went to a farmer's market in San Francisco, and they took a banana and cut it into pieces and put half of that banana on a plate and the other half on another plate, and one was labeled organic, and had people come and sample it, and the people absolutely swore that the organic banana tasted better. So I mean, the public perception is what it is, and I'm just after truth in advertising. So thank you very much for the time.
Thank you very much. Yes.
If you remember, Jeff, there was a pretty big push on the national level as to how they were going to define organics.
Right.
And I remember there was a significant campaign from around the country of individuals trying to make certain, because you did have, let's say, some individuals in the industry who wanted to make certain it was broad enough to allow for stuff that we would consider through like Oregon Tilth was not organic to be labeled organic, so they could actually get on that edge, because the market share shows that for organics, it's just going through the ceiling.
Yep. It is, Ms. Chair, I don't have issues with the organic farmers using what they have to bring their crop in. I don't. It's just a question of full disclosure. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
So with that, we're going to have Katie Koba, Jim Kramer, anybody else you want to bring, Katie? You're welcome to bring them up. And again, for the committee, because we're having a lot of issues that are around this, it isn't called organic, but if you think about the bills we have, 633, the Valley stuff, organics are a part of that with respect to some of the farmers. And I just thought it would be good to understand what it takes to be labeled as organic from the federal law. So that's why this hearing is here today.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. With me is Jim Kramer, who is a program director for our market access and certification programs, and Lindsay Benson-Ing, who is actually our certifications manager and manages our multitude of certification programs in the agency,
yes,
of which our organic certification program is just one. And so I just wanted to give a brief overview and then turn it over to Jim, and he's got the real expert here, Lindsay, to answer questions. But I would say, in general, what we're seeing in terms of the marketplace around certifications are just exploding. So we do GAP certification, good agricultural practices certification. We do GIP certification, good handling practices, organic. We do a certification program for onion producers. Some of these are national programs. Some of these are where producers have come to the department and asked us to actually conduct audits, help them develop standards, and then conduct the audits for their specific programs. And what we're seeing in the marketplace is a huge growth in demand for all variety of certification. And I will use the term, you know, red, blue, green, yellow, big, small, whatever, you name it. We're just seeing kind of an explosion around the market demand for certification programs in general. Within the agency, it's 100% fee-for-service, so we recover the costs that it takes to run the program by charging a fee for those services, just as we do with the organic program. We've now been doing organic certification within the agency for about 4 years, and we're not the only entity in the state that does those. It's up to the producer to choose which entity they want to come and certify them. So we kind of have a group of producers that we work with, but there are other certifiers that actually probably certify more organic in the state than we do. With that, I think I will go ahead and turn it over to Jim, and he was just going to kind of give you the basics of what the program is and what we do.
Okay, very good. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Kramer. So I thought what I'd do is just kind of walk you through kind of the inception. So the National Organic Program became a national program in 2000. And kind of the reason for that was to bring in some sanity into the marketplace. And it was a push by all of the different state programs and different entities that were certifying organic. Organic meant many different things, right?
Exactly.
So trying to just bring some of that sanity into the marketplace. And then, as Katie said, in 2009, at the request of a lot of the producers that we interact with on a daily basis for other certification programs, they asked us to become a certifying entity. Katie mentioned other certifiers. There's about 9 or 10 different certifying entities for the National Organic Program here. kind of important to know that the organic program is kind of based on a on an audit-based systematic. Okay, it's not a test every product and see if there's any banned substances or any of that within it. So each organic request comes in, they have to have their plan on how they manage their farm or they manage their packing operation or whatever. And so it's systematic. So across all of the organic certifiers within the program, there's also a requirement that for our program, we have to randomly select 5% of the folks that we certify. And we will test them for pesticide residues. And we do that based on some targeting kinds of information. So we'll pick our five and kind of see where they're located, if there's a potential for maybe an obvious drift or something like that, if it might be up blueberries and maybe they're using fungicides. And next to them is another facility, the organic facility. We might test then specifically for fungicide in that, see if there's anything. There's also a tolerance, which I think everybody should know too, that so an organic farm could have, and maybe this is to Senator Cruz's point, could have a minor amount of an unintended consequence. Actually, it's very minor. It's 5% of the EPA tolerance. So you talk about general use of chemicals and their tolerances. In organics, it's 5% of that, and it could still be labeled as organic. Okay, it's a very, very small amount. And we test for that. So and all certifiers, whether it's ODA or the other nine, all are under this National Organic Program where they are going to have to select randomly 5% of the people that they certify and do some testing on that. Maybe also to note, there's only one other state organic program in the U.S., and that's California has their own state organic program. And again, the National Organic Program was to lessen the confusion, standardize things among states, and actually make marketing a little bit easier. If you set up higher standards than somebody else, then you might cause problems on the whole marketing distribution of things. So that was another good reason for them to for everybody to request a National Organic Program. Maybe also of note, under the organic rules, any producer that's producing and selling as organics, they're only required to have an organic inspection certification if they're selling $5,000 or more of things. So real small farms can be exempt from that, though they are required to follow the standard. They do not have to be officially certified by an organic certifier. So that's across there. Because we're not a state organic program, any complaints of misuse or that's handled through the National Organic Program back in D.C. So while we may receive a complaint, if we do, we will pass that on. They're the regulatory branch or the regulatory arm of their standards. So we do not do any enforcement like that. All of our audits that we do about 65. Currently, we do about 65 different facilities between producers and handlers. All of that information is provided to the feds under the National Organic Program. All certifiers are required to go through an audit by the National Organic Program. It's fairly expensive and fairly intensive. So about every 3 years we go through that also. And that's, again, for consistency and uniformity across the program. So I would leave it at that unless you had some specific questions, which Lindsay would probably have to answer, but I'm happy to do so.
So any questions? Because I have a few. Okay. Senator Baird, sure.
You want me to go first?
Sure. Might take care of mine. I don't have to ask them.
Well, on my farm, I looked into the organic, getting certified organic, and what struck me is, and you feel free to disagree, but it seems like it's kind of the honor system on the certification process, and you could probably go your whole career and never be inspected.
So we are
go to the microphone.
I'm Lindsay Ang. For the record, the organic program manager for the ODA. And we're actually under the federal rules for all accredited certifying agents. We're required to do an annual inspection of all certified operations. No one receives certification until they've had an on-site inspection, verifying their practices that they've submitted in their organic system plan, as well as 5% of unannounced inspections for our clients that we do on an annual basis when they don't know we're coming as well.
Could you elaborate on what those inspections consist of?
Yeah, and there's actually some. So as Jim said, that it's a process-based certification. So it's based on the plan that's submitted. But there's a lot of checks in there as well. So we're looking at every input that they're using, looking in chemical storage sheds, looking at application rates, those kinds of things to ensure that all of those are consistent with the federal requirements. And there's a specific list of chemicals that they can use and other inputs. And there's also, we do sales audits for how much organic product they're selling.
Yes.
We do in-out balances audits, so we're looking at, especially if we have a handler that's using multiple ingredients, we'll look at the amount of organic ingredients that are coming in, the amount that's going out, to kind of balance that there's not using any conventional or other ingredients that they couldn't be using or that aren't approved. Thank you.
Yeah, I just thought, you know, it'd be very difficult for the department to absolutely know if somebody is adhering to the rules or not, I guess what I was getting at.
Okay.
If you go, you do the 5% test, and if your audit shows that they have higher levels than they should have, more than the 5% allowable, do you then send that to the national, and then they make the decision of whether they're going to do anything with that particular?
Chair Roblin, that's right. And you know, last year we happened to find in our random a hit, but it was below the EPA, it was below the 5% tolerance. So, yeah, we make that available, but in this case there was no reason for a regulatory action, but absolutely we'd pass that information on.
And have we had anybody that was in our state, in the work you've done, where it's ever exceeded the limit and they've had to do something to pull a labeling from any farmer or any?
Chair Roblin, not during our inspection process, but it may happen. So maybe like on a border piece of production with a conventional farm, it's possible, maybe even likely, that that border side of things may get some drift or something. And then the organic farmer would have the option of moving that into the conventional side, that bordered piece production. Okay, as long as it still was within the EPA tolerance, it would still be legal for sale in the conventional.
But has any of that ever been discovered in a way that was they were fined or the federal government came and took action against any organic farmer?
Not in Oregon since we've been certifying.
And who are the other 9 or so certifiers? I mean, not who are they, but where do they come from? Or is it, are they state? Or are they bigger than the state? Are they small?
Well, I'll let Lindsay answer that.
Okay.
Oregon Tilt is probably the biggest one and,
right.
and most well-known in the state. But they're the CCOF, that's a California certifying entity, Indiana something or other. There's a host of them, but I don't know if, Lindsay, you want to add more to that.
QAI, Quality Assurance International, does a lot of work here, organic certifiers. So there's some California or global certifiers similar to Oregon Tilt that work across state lines, state private certifiers.
Okay, and so that goes to my next question, which says international. So because I'll go to Safeway or someplace, and there'll be an organic, and I know that banana was not grown in the U.S. I mean, it isn't. It wasn't here. So
labeled Ecuador.
Yeah. Labeled Ecuador, and some are organic, some aren't. So is that so?
All international imported products that are labeled for organic in the U.S. need to be certified to the National Organic Program Standard. So that means that their certifier, they need to have an NOP accredited certifier certifying them within their country. So there's a lot, there's quite a few international. So I think there's 141 accredited certifiers across the globe to the NOP standard. Many of those are foreign certifiers, and the NOP has the same oversight over them as they do us. So they're doing on-site visits and auditing them. They're also seeing any of their adverse actions, seeing their pesticide reports, those kinds of things.
Okay. That's good to know. Yes. Senator Pazanski.
We're into chocolate. And there's, of course, I'm getting a lot of chocolate. And we just came across one that's called Alter Eco. And I was wondering if you're familiar with it, because it looks like it's a sustainability group that's international, and they're starting to bring stuff in. But it just seems like you're finding a lot of opportunities where individuals who want to see, let's say, fair trade, sustainability are starting to pop up, I'm going to say, internationally. products. So I'm not sure if you've come across them.
I have not.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Other questions about the organic farming and all of that kind of stuff? I mean, we've heard testimony, and I guess this is the part that had me the most concerned, that because we keep asking if there have been any crossovers with respect to some of these plants that are growing, and all of a sudden they get in the we have a GMO product grown next to another one, and so they're worried that the they could be pollinated, and therefore they may have to make decisions with regard to their organic farm and whatever. Have we had any of those situations where it actually resulted in required getting rid of a field of this or that? Or
for our certified clients in terms of GMO or pesticide, for that matter, we have not had that circumstance. The USDA National Organic Program did just put out a policy paper on GM. They've been looking into the issue. And that's also something that can be tested for. But again, it's a systems approach. So unintended adventitious presence of GMO would not in and of itself disqualify you from selling the product as organic, as long as the producer was following the practices set out in the law.
Okay. Yes.
Has, under your program, has anybody lost their certification for anything in the state or you know, any of their organic certification? And if so, what was the reason?
We've had a few. We've had a number of different issues. Either their product didn't qualify. They had submitted maybe a system plan that was not compliant, and they weren't able to be compliant with the National Organic Standards. They may have had a prohibited substance on their property, and they cannot be selling. They can't be certified for up to 3 years. We also have, in some cases, people that are suspended or lose their certification for not communicating, not submitting annual updates, not paying their bills, those kinds of things.
Okay. Any other questions for the people? I really appreciate it. It's still murky to me that there are so many different certifiers. I'm taking from you that all of them have to have their people who go out and do the work trained into the same standard. So that makes me feel a little better, but it's still interesting. So mm-hmm. I should, if my wife is buying organic food, we should trust the fact that some, at one time, the farm that grew that had somebody on site inspecting, and that there are random checks to make sure that they are doing and following the procedures.
That's true.
Regardless of who it was who was inspecting it.
That's true.
As long as they're one of these certified programs.
Right.
Absolutely.
Has there been an attempt by any people to come in and say they're certifiers when they aren't? Do we know of any of that kind of stuff happening?
No, it would be punishable under the federal law act as a because you're essentially acting under USDA.
And accredited.
Yeah. But they do check for fraudulent certificates. That does happen every once in a while, and those are published and investigated and found. Generally, they're foreign entities. So.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions to this panel? Well, thank you very much for coming today.
You're welcome,
we appreciate it. So we're going to close our informational meeting on overview of National Organic Program and Standards and Senate Bill 603. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 677. And with that, we'll have a short explanation. And Senator Thompson, come on up. You can bring whoever you want. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 677 creates an exception to the requirement that seasonal farm workers' wages be paid immediately upon termination of employment. It allows an employer until noon on the day after the termination of employment to pay the seasonal farm worker. If termination occurs at the end of the harvest season, the employer is a farm worker camp operator, and the farm worker is providing housing at no cost until wages are paid.
And with that, Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, committee members. Thanks for having us today. I'm here with Ramon Ramirez on Senate Bill 677. Did I get that right?
Yep.
Good. Okay. The issue before us today, it's a ag labor issue. It kind of brought to my attention this last summer. We found there was a company down Southern Oregon that ran into a case to where they had an issue, and the issue was that it was brought up that we, on the last day of your last harvest, that you must pay immediately. Well, I've been in this business a long time, and I really didn't even know that statute existed. So when we found that out, it was taken to court, questioned, and what did immediate mean? There was no real definition at that time of immediate. Found out immediate in court was said before midnight. So when everybody heard about this, it became problematic, very difficult to be doing the harvesting, because most people that are farmers around or folks just like me were busy with the managing or driving tractors or driving semis, and at the end of the day having to get all the figures ready and then go back in, and we, like myself, we do our own payrolls, and just a matter of not being able to get that done in a timely manner. This year what happened to me was I was leaving on a Friday to go to China with the chair, and we were going to get done harvesting the next morning. My daughter, who's the only other person in the family that knows how to do the payroll, was visiting her boyfriend in Tacoma, and I could not get her to come back down because she just wouldn't do it. Right? So what I had to do was lay off our crew of 50 people, delay a day. So normally that group, our folks picking for us that day, would have gone to the Upper Valley in Parkdale and been working all day. But because of that statute, and I was afraid to be against that statute, we delayed a day. They came to work the next day on Sunday to finish. My daughter came down from Tacoma, was able to get the payroll done by midnight. So I really don't think that statute was designed that way, because that's not what we want to have happen in the industry for both the laborers and for the farmers. So it's a bad situation. So I got to thinking, this, we need to do something about that. And this is how I met Ramon. We got together with the nurseries, and they set up a meeting with me and Ramon and Legal Services and CASA, and I told them the story, and they came back with the legislation that is in front of you today. They were gracious enough to listen to my story, and I listened to their story, and they came with the language, and I think it's a win-win for everybody, because it gives us until noon the next day to get our payroll done if you have ag labor housing, which many people do. Some people don't, but the originality, we believe, we found 17 years ago, I think Ramon told me this story, was the reason this statute was put in, because 17 years ago, somebody that had ag labor housing finished harvest, shut their camps down, and didn't pay their employees that day. So where are they going to live? And that was the issue. What it came to kind of be, we didn't even know this existed. So it's a fix, and hopefully with this hearing, and we've done some newspaper articles in the Capital Press, we'll get this communication out, and people will know that we need to, after the last day of harvest, have to get our checks ready by noon the next day. And it's a great compromise, and I want to give a lot of kudos to Ramon and Legal Services for working with us on this bill.
Thank you.
Ramon. Thank you. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Ramon Ramirez. I'm president of the Oregon Farm Worker Union, PECUN. And, you know, for the since our founding in 1985, PECUN has worked tirelessly to improve the living and working conditions of farm workers. Over the last 17 years, we have supported this statute primarily because there are some bad actors out there, and they were taking advantage of farm workers in two ways. One is that they would, and these were folks that had labor camps, and they would shut down their labor camps, and then workers would have to look for a hotel or a place to stay. Sometimes they would stay in their vans or vehicles. And also that there was some unscrupulous labor contractors that were just telling people, well, come back tomorrow or the next day, and then they would not pay. So that was the original intent of the legislation and the creation of this statute. However, when Senator Thompson sought us out, and he brought all of us together, and he told us his story, we felt like compelled that we had to change, we had to tweak the law, so that farmers that play by the rules, that do pay their workers, that treat their workers with respect, that that they shouldn't be penalized for this. So we think that under Senate Bill 677, by allowing those farmers to pay the next day, would allow them to, you know, bring in their crop and, you know, and market the crop, whatever they have to do. And it's a fair way. We think it's a fair way that, and a reasonable timeline or time frame, so that they can do that and at the same time pay the workers. Now, the reason why we wanted to do the next day, and then we put in a provision where that the labor camp would not be closed, so that an additional charges or rent would not be charged to these workers. There are growers that don't charge for their labor camp, and there are others that don't. But nevertheless, we think that they have to, you know, leave the labor camp open so that these workers are not burdened with an extra day. And the other thing is that we wanted to get the workers out to their next job site. Many times workers line up jobs months in advance. They contact their grower many times out of state or out of the region. I was in our conversations with Senator Thompson. He told us that many of his workers go up to the Yakima Valley, and so we want to make sure that that those workers are paid in time, that there's not an additional burden, and we felt this was a good compromise, and that's why we urge this committee to vote yes to pass Senate Bill 677.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
I have a comment.
Yes.
You know, I know Senator Thompson and I talked about this issue, and I work with the forest workers side, and I think this is a real good fix, because I understand, you know, when they quit working for me, they want to go to the next job, and but yet on the other side, it's the burden of the paperwork on the employer. Sometimes it takes, especially nowadays, with all the forms that we have to conform to do payroll, it takes a little time. So I applaud both of you. This is a real good fix. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator and Chair. I just want to make a comment that it's been really a pleasure to work with Senator Thompson. You know, I think we gave him a lot of insight in terms of why we've come to this decision, and then he was also good at explaining to us, that he was a victim of this law that had been in the books for 17 years. And then once we explained sort of like the history of why we needed this law in the books, and he really understood, and that's what, I mean, we've came together, tweak it a little bit so that growers that play by the rules, you know, this doesn't affect them, because, you know, and we're really concerned about, and because there's still problems in farm labor. I just attended a Department of Labor hearing yesterday up in Portland, and in that hearing, you know, I agreed a lot with what they're saying, is because there are some, there are still bad actors out there, and what we're trying to do is punish them and not the, the good guys.
Okay. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
So next, John McCauley and
Jeff Heater.
Jeff Heater. And Katie Fass.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCauley, here representing the tree fruit industry, which are the growers in the Mid-Columbia area and also in northeastern Oregon and Umatilla County. We're here today in support of Senate Bill 677 for the reasons that Senator Thompson outlined. We think it's really a good bill. It's very narrow, as was described to you, and we think that it's an important bill to pass. I'm going to have Jeff Heater, who actually will be affected by the bill, discuss more with you.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and Senators. My name is Jeff Heater, for the record. I am a farmer in Wasco County, the Dalles. I grow cherries and apples. And I know Senator Thompson, and he and I have had a discussion about this bill, and like him, I was unaware that payment needed to be made when I lay off my crew. I have a pretty small orchard, and paying the crew immediately upon finishing harvest is close to impossible with all the paperwork that has to be done. You know, I'm out in the field driving the tractor, hauling the fruit into the warehouse. By the time you get done with all that, the crew's been done working for maybe 3 or 4 hours. If you get home at 8 o'clock at night and you only have 4 hours to do a payroll of 50 or 60 people, it puts a lot of pressure on you, and quite often running the risk of going too fast to meet a timeline, the risk of creating errors in your payroll goes up quite high. And the idea of taking some of this timeline burden off, allowing yourself just another 12 hours till noon the following day, really makes it much easier to go through in a timely fashion and without the rush and obvious threat for miscalculations.
Thank you. Katie.
Good afternoon. For the record, Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Farm Bureau is in support of Senate Bill 677. I think you've heard some of the good reasons why, but you know, our farmers are there working long shifts with their workers, and the ability to come in and get that payroll done immediately sometimes is challenging for these small operators. Additionally, you know, harvest for some of these crops can end in the middle of the night. And so it is better if people get a good night's sleep before those numbers are calculated. You know, I'd just like to clarify for the record that in terms of this compromise, you know, it's for a narrow fix for the industry. Mainly housing's done in a lot of the orchard situations, and some here in the valley around berries. And so, you know, a lot of growers were not aware that the definition of immediately was the same day. You know, so this has been a concerning point for the industry, and I think this is a positive compromise to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this group? Seeing none, thank you all.
Thank you.
Next we have Brady Cayuca. I'll get that right. And Sybil Hibb.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Kiyokawa. I'm a grower in the Hood River Valley. I live in Parkdale. Hood River Valley has about, I'm testifying in favor of Senate Bill 677. There's about 300 growers in the valley. Most of us are still family farms, and we don't have bookkeepers on site. The bookkeeper for our operation, you see him right here. I really would like to be able to go and when I do go and do my payroll, it's a very important part of my business, and to get a good night's sleep and work on it in the morning. There's times when we finish up harvest and it's 5-6 o'clock, whether we might have another crew come in and do some packing. I'm driving the truck into Portland to do from some farmers markets, and I don't get back till 11, 12 at night, even if I'm able to come back. So those extra 12 hours from midnight to noon the next day would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today also to offer my support. As you know, the Law Center is a nonprofit legal services provider. Our clients are people who make within 185% of the federal poverty level and below, and we have offices in 17 communities across the state providing services statewide. And the bulk of our services are in the family law arena, and so you mostly hear from me about those issues, but we also do a substantial amount of work in housing stability and also in employment stability and employment law. And so we provide services to people who are working in the industry and the agricultural field. And so we very much appreciated the senators reaching out to us and talking to us about this issue, and we were really glad for the opportunity to sit down with him. We did have some concerns about practices in the past and from some of the bad actors who caused great trouble and crisis for our clients, but we are very excited about supporting the work of the good actors and the senator and the interested parties who came together to sit down. I think we really were able to talk to one another and get at what the concerns were, and we feel like this is a reasonable compromise moving forward, and we're very appreciative. So thanks.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. That wraps up the testimony of the people signed up. Is there anybody else in the area that would like to speak to Senate Bill 677? Committee, we have about four bills, I think, that we have heard that we're ready to work. So on Thursday, including this bill, we will be doing some work sessions on those that we've already heard. But we didn't schedule for a possible work session, so we aren't going to do it today. So with that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 677, and maybe we'll see you here Thursday. And now we're going to open an informational on research on canola. As you know, we have a bill in our possession that has to do with canola in the fields, and we would like to get as much information as we can to make a good decision about that. So I'm going to invite Carol Mallory Smith and Russ Caro to come up front if they are. And we're going to open our informational hearing on the research on canola at OSU. And I really appreciate you being here, and happy we could make it for you for your whole day, right, since you got to start over in the house. And we didn't want to have to bring you back and forth, but we really did want to. And I also want to thank, I think you sent in a letter to us as well that we have in,
Dr. Caro did.
Yes. So with that, whoever wants to start, we'd just love to hear.
Okay. Senator Roblin and committee members, I had sent in some information to Raquel, and I think she may have crafted that information into some sort of document for you. And then this morning in the House, the House hearing, I provided a document as well, and I think that you have copies of that also.
Yep.
And so what I would like to do at this time is to basically run through that document.
Your name first, too.
Oh, yes, for the record. Yeah. Russ Caro, head of the Department of Crop and Soil Science at Oregon State University.
Thank you.
So what I would like to do is to run through that document and to use that as background for you, and I think that'll set the context for some of the other discussion that will follow. Dr. Carol Mallory Smith has actually been involved in the actual research and can give you some of that detail. My role over time has been more of an information gatherer and facilitator on the part of Oregon State University's involvement with ODA and growers trying to wrestle with this particular issue. So background on myself. And I guess a disclaimer before I go further, we said this morning as well, OSU does not have a position on the production of canola in the Willamette Valley, and some of the statements that I am going to make, there may be others in the Oregon University system that don't agree with those. So we have professional people working on many different sides of the issue, and other folks may have other opinions. But I'm trying to give you just some background for some history of what's gone on with canola in the state. My background itself, I came to Oregon in 1983. I was an extension cereal specialist. I've got a PhD in plant breeding and genetics and agronomy. In that role as extension cereal specialist, I've worked with growers, ag industry across the state for many, many years. I moved into my department head role in 2000 as an interim head, and then 2001 as the full-time head for the department. And having moved into that role, I now work with not only the wheat growers and grain growers of the state, but potato, metafoam, grass seed, so have a fairly broad perspective on ag industry, the field crop ag industry across the state. My work with canola actually began in 1986. At that point in time, around the world, there was interest in a cool season, a temperate season, oilseed crop. Canola is a crop that was bred in Canada. Canadian oil is where the name comes from. Rape seeds, which canola is a type of, prior to the late 1970s, early 1980s, was an industrial oil. It had an oil composition that, at least in the United States, was not viewed as being edible. And the glucosinolates, a material that's found in the meal, made it unusable at high quantities as a feed. So the Canadians actually bred using standard breeding techniques those components out of rapeseed and created canola. And the real interest was in Europe at that point in time. Europe was dependent on other parts of the world for oil sources. And with the advent of an edible oil that could be grown in cool climates, there was a spike in world oil prices, edible oil prices. And so we saw prices that were 2 to 3 times normal prices in order to incentivize oil production. Some of that spilled over into Oregon at that period of time, and there was interest both in eastern Oregon, is where things started, and then in western Oregon in the late 1980s, early 1990s. I actually conducted, as part of my agronomic work, variety trials at Hislop Farm on European varieties, and some of the varieties being bred in Idaho. There was commercial production and seed stock production of canola in western Oregon in the early 1990s. A company named SeedTech had contracted acreage with growers. But as happens with many ag commodities, the price bubble that was there disappeared. And as the prices plummeted without some of the subsidies that were in place around the world, interest in canola, at least in western Oregon, diminished, and the crop essentially went away for a period of time. It has continued in eastern Oregon as a rotation crop, and in recent years we're actually seeing the acreage go up significantly once again, because they've solved one of the production problems that they faced in eastern Oregon in growing canola. Why are we interested in canola at all? It's because of the ability that it has to be used as a rotation crop. So if you look at the Willamette Valley, we truly have a unique environment here. If you look at any of the climate modeling that's done around the world, there are probably a half dozen other spots that have an environment similar to ours. So because of that environment, the mild winters, dry summers, limited rainfall, or mild conditions during the summer as well, we can grow exceptional seed crops. And you're well aware of that, both on the grass seed and in the specialty seeds. And that truly is unique and something that we have to keep in mind. As you look at acreages, the grass seed acreage and grain acreage are magnitudes higher than what we have in specialty seeds. So you have probably 300, depending on the year, 350, 400,000 acres of grass seed, at least 100,000 acres of grains, of wheat predominantly. And both of those are grass crops. The problem you have in growing grass after grass are grassy weeds. So the number one pest in that grass and grain rotation in the valley at this point are things like annual bluegrass, which we don't have good herbicides to control. So the best control from an integrated pest management standpoint is to go to a broadleaf crop. and to break that, the cereal or grass rotation. And a typical rotation would be 3 years of grass and grain and then into a broadleaf if you could do that. At this point in time, oftentimes the grass crops have wheat as the break, but you still end up with grassy weeds. So ideally, you'd like a broadleaf crop where you can come in with a grass herbicide and control the grassy weeds. It also breaks up some of the other disease and pest cycles that you may have building in that three-year period of time, or the period of time that the grass and grain is growing. So in a very simplistic sense, if you were to look at the valley, if you've got 400, 500 acres of grass and grains, and you were to rotate, grow those crops every 3 years, rotate to a broadleaf crop every fourth year, you'd need 100, 125,000 acres of a broadleaf crop. And that's where something like canola comes in. Canola is, as we said, a worldwide crop. There's over 21 million acres of canola being grown in North America at this point in time. So the 100, 125,000 acres that we would grow in Oregon is insignificant in that larger scheme of things. And so it becomes almost an ideal rotation crop in that you could move in and out of that market at will. It's a cash market, so it's not, you don't have to contract with somebody to grow canola, and you can get cash very shortly after delivery of the crop. The closest point at this point in time outside of Oregon to deliver canola would be up in North Dakota. Velva, North Dakota is one of the closest places. The canola price in Velva at this point is 24 cents a pound. Depending on how you want to calculate transportation, if you were to use rail, you'd knock 3-4 cents a pound off of that price to end up with the Willamette Valley price. And so you'd be looking at least 20 cents a pound locally. If the crop was processed locally, which there is the capability to do at the plant in Riccreol, you'd expect to be at least at that national price of 24 cents. But you've cash market, you've got, we could move in and out of canola without affecting prices. There's other rotation crops besides grains being used. We've got a fair amount of legume seed that's being grown in the valley. There's about 40,000 acres of clovers, peas, and other legume crops. There's about a little under 5,000 acres of meadowfoam, which is a viable rotation crop for the grasses and grains as well in some situations. But there is a need for other crops. This morning in the House, they asked about alfalfa. Alfalfa is growing on 9 to 10,000 acres in the Willamette Valley. It's a perennial crop, so you'd have to grow it at least 2 to 3 years in order to generate the value that you'd want to get out of a crop like alfalfa. It's not something that it is grown in some parts of the nation as an annual, but typically is grown as a perennial. So as you're looking at rotations, it wouldn't quite fit the annual crop model that you'd want in a rotation. But there are other possibilities out there as far as alternate crops. And again, as I said, grains are being used at this point in time. If you look at value, you'll hear consistently that the specialty seeds have a value of $40 million, $50 million. If you were to look at the value of 100 to 125,000 acres of canola at a yield of 2,500 to 3,000 pounds per acre at a price of 20 cents per pound, you would surpass that value. So in a very simplistic sense, if you wanted, you could rotate entirely out to something like canola and have equal value in the ag community. Nobody is suggesting that we do that at all. You know, we're looking at a very conservative acreage that has been proposed by ODA. But if you were to run the numbers, you know, you need to keep those sorts of things in mind. Growing canola, it's very light. It will be a mechanized crop. That's one of the advantages. You'd have very few people involved in harvest. And if you ship it out of here, there's no multipliers in the local environment. Specialty seeds, on the other hand, have very significant multiplier effects, very significant numbers of people involved in production. And those multipliers aren't included in the dollar values that are assigned oftentimes to the crop. So if you were to grow canola, cross-pollination is indeed an issue. The specialty seed growers have addressed the cross-pollination issue by using mile to 3 mile isolation distances around the crops that they grow. So if you were to have canola and if you use the same 3 mile isolation distance that they're using within the specialty seed industry, if you had coordination between the growers, among the growers of the crops, you could maintain some of those same isolation distances. And so the current season isolation becomes less of a problem, or could be less of a problem. The real issue is the amount of volunteer that you'd have left over in a field. If there is scatter along roadsides as you're transporting harvest equipment or transporting the crop, or if you get there may be, people have reported rare instances where at harvest you leave a huge amount of seed out in the field, and then if we get an odd rainstorm where there's significant rainfall, you could actually move some of the seed in overland water flow into waterways and transport it down who knows where in the system. So the real issue that I think people are looking at is this background noise that's potentially there for not only canola, but brassicas of many types, and trying to deal with that, the background brassica that's out there with the potential for cross-pollination is a true concern. Diseases will increase, there's no doubt about that, but what the effect will be, we don't know. Some of the same, sclerotinia is a major disease in canola. Sclerotinia is also present in clovers, in beans, in peas, so you've already got sclerotinia in the background. Cabbage maggot is a real concern. Again, we don't quite know the dynamics because the canola is grown out of cycle with some of the other brassica crops, but cabbage maggot is an extreme concern for the fresh root vegetable growers. And they need to be protected not only from canola, but they need to consider where other brassicas are being grown because of that issue. So there will be, and Dr. Mallory Smith can address some of the specifics of those kind of concerns. What ODA has been trying to do is to figure out, is there a model for coexistence between canola growers and the specialty seed growers? We've had 8 years of conversations since 2005, with almost 6 years at this point, or eight years still, on this topic, and haven't been able to come to any resolution. And so that's where we get to the regulation that we have today. I think as Director Koba has identified, you've carved out the middle of the Willamette Valley, the area where you have the highest concentration of specialty seed. You've opened up the fringes of the valley. And the question at this point is, can you control some of the volunteer and other issues in those fringe areas such that it doesn't impact the specialty seed industry? I've laid out some scenarios in here. The choice you have is either to ban canola. If you're going to ban canola, you need to figure out how do we come up with alternate crops, other alternative crop alternatives for the people that are growing grasses and grains. And if we go ahead with canola production, we still need to do some baseline work, as was proposed in the emergency board funding, so that we know what's happening out in the fields. And if we've got a better idea of what specific crop rotations, specific management practices are going to do in those fields, we can design best management practices beyond what are already suggested in the rule that ODA has in place. But you're going to need that kind of information in order to further refine the system that we have. So with that, I'll stop there.
Thank you. Carol.
Okay. Chair Robin and members of the committee. My name is Carol Mallory Smith. I'm a professor of weed science at Oregon State University at the Corvallis campus. I was a member of the research team that did the research originally on the introduction of canola into the Willamette Valley. And I've also worked on some other gene flow issues between crops and weeds and other hybridization issues. I have a few comments, and I would also echo Dr. Caro's comment that I'm speaking not for Oregon State University, nor even other members of the research committee, which we might not all agree upon. From my perspective, though, all segments of agriculture are extremely important, especially in the Willamette Valley. And when we talk about those segments, we have the organic production, we have seed and we have processing. And that's just a small segment of some of the different sectors that we have. But the value in the Willamette Valley is in diversity, and protecting that diversity of all the crops becomes very important. But making choices about that diversity based only on dollar value becomes very problematic when trying to maintain as many crops as can be grown here in the Willamette Valley. And therefore, I also think from my perspective, coexistence is critical, and coming up with ways for these crops to be grown together is extremely important. But having said that, and that I think coexistence is extremely important, there is no way that we can guarantee zero risk. And that is sort of where we get to with canola, is trying to define what that risk potentially could be to those industries. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the research that we did conduct. We had some specific research. We were looking at the potential for hybridization between canola and some of the brassica vegetable crops. We were also looking at this seed loss in the field, how many seeds could be lost in the field, and then what the volunteer issues would be in future crops. Did some monitoring of some of the pests and diseases, which I specifically was not involved with, but that was also done in this. And I'll start with some of the things that are sort of clearer and head towards the muddier water later. One thing that I really want to make clear think is very important to keep in perspective is canola is not biologically unique from other crops or plants that we grow. So there's nothing magical about canola as being a bad actor in the system. It's a crop. It's not a weed. I know that people would put forth that it is weed. It is a weed, but it is not a weed. But it has weedy characteristics, as do many crops that we grow here in the Willamette Valley, including some of our grass seed crops. And some of the specialty seed crops also have weedy characteristics. One of the other things is that we cannot control pollen movement. Pollen moves around in the environment. If you have hay fever, you know that even more. So, but it does move around in the environment. And in the case of canola pollen, it's moved both by wind and by insects, so it has the potential to move from site to site. This is also true, though, of pollen from other crops, including the brassica specialty seed crops. So pollen moves. That's pretty much a fact. In some of our crossing work, we did see that we could have hybridization between canola and the brassica vegetable crops that are being grown. It was very dependent upon the specific cultivar of those brassicas. And in some cases, it made a difference even within one of those crops. If the cultivar was slightly different, it made a difference. So it's going to be very hard to predict exactly what would happen with hybridization, but it will occur, just as it occurs between the brassica seed crops, which is why, as Dr. Carroll said, they have isolation distances. They put isolation distances out there now to protect the purity of the seed that's being produced now, which would be the same as if you had isolation distances with canola. And just as we can't control pollen movement, we can't control seed movement. We lose seed in agriculture during planting, during harvest, during cleaning, during transportation. And if you're familiar with anything that's growing around roadsides, especially in agricultural areas, you'll pretty much be able to tell what growers are growing in that area because you're going to see those plants there. So that's not unique also to canola. And so in that case, I think that some of the issues that do come along with this is that we do know that we will get quite a bit of canola shatter in the field, and then we would have potential for high volunteer populations in the future years. The length of time that the canola seed would last in the fields is going to depend on grower practices. Sort of tillage versus no tillage can have an impact. Again, the specific cultivar canola could have an impact, whether there are more dormant seeds or not in that particular cultivar. So, again, that would make some difference in what we're going to see in the following years. However, in these systems where they would be using canola as a rotational crop in their grass seed or wheat production, it will be very possible for growers to control those volunteers in those crops. And in addition to that, if you drive around and look around this time of year, you are going to see yellow flowers out there, and those are mustard plants, brassic plants, unless it's a dandelion or a daffodil right now, more than likely what you're going to be seeing are brassica plants. So they already exist out there in the environment. Some of them are cultivated that have been released from cultivation, and some of them could be weed species. So in that case, it's not, again, canola is not going to be unique in this system. Two other, and this is where maybe we're getting into a little bit more muddied water here. There are brassica acres that are being produced that don't really fall under the specialty seed industry. This is what we call purple top turnip that's being grown for cover crop. It's being grown for seed, but it's for cover crops rather than in the specialty vegetable crops. So there are acres of that. It's hard to get a handle on how many acres of that are being grown. And in addition to that, we also have radish that's being grown for the cover crop market. And again, we don't have the number of acres that are being produced, but it's significant. So in the case of the turnip, that is another brassica species where the hybridization cross-pollination could occur. And with the radish, there's not going to be hybridization, but the pests and diseases in those species are going to be very similar to what would be in any of the other brassica crops. So, and with those two other, the purple top turnip and the radish that are being grown for seed, acreage could be estimated to be more than what we'd be talking about with canola, but we actually don't have those numbers. So I think it would be extremely important to be aware of what those numbers might look like, those acres would look like when you're thinking about controlling a specific other crop, and those crops are sort of not being considered in this whole equation. I agree with Dr. Caro that we will see pests and diseases increase if we increase acreages of brassica crops, whether it's canola or just other brassica crops, or in addition, the radishes. So I think in that case, we will see. It just is logical, and it's what you would expect to see with increased acreages. So then we get to also what can our research that we've already done tell us about a scale-up. And that's where it becomes problematic, because the research we did was on very small acreages, very controlled acreages, and when we start to scale up to higher numbers of acres, it's going to be very hard to predict exactly what could happen with that. So I don't think that we can specifically answer those kinds of questions. In order to do some of that in the future, we'd have to do more monitoring of the acres that are going to be put in, and in addition to that, we would need to know where these other acres of brassica and radish fields are so that we could actually monitor those at the same time And the also the other thing is the isolation distances. Again, the scale up where isolation distances should work to for separating canola from the other brassicas, just as we separate brassica from brassica, scaling up might impact that, where we would have bigger fields with more pollen out there, and it's possible that it, that could have a different impact than what we would see, but that's fairly unpredictable. So I think that that is, I'll leave you with that, and if you have questions, but I come back to, you know, we can't guarantee zero risk in any of these systems.
Questions?
I've got a series because I want to get some stuff on the record.
Sure.
So, you know, talking to some of my relatives that farm in the Midwest, North Dakota, and Minnesota, they use canola at times for rotation crop there. I said, what are the problems? And they really didn't have any problems except for the new Roundup Ready canola that has been popping up in the Roundup Ready cornfields, so there's only one way to get it out. Same with the soybeans. But we're not dealing with Roundup Ready canola in Oregon, or are we?
Chair Roblin and Senator Bart Sugar, we are not at this time, mostly I would say because the canola varieties that we'd have would not be adapted very well for this area. There, the canola growers in the beginning of all of these discussions were willing to say that they weren't going to plant GMO canola, but that's really not part of the rule at all.
Okay.
But in addition, I'd just add to that is that even if we had GMO canola, it is possible to control it, especially because it wouldn't be going into other Roundup Ready crops. So,
okay. And the pollen issue, is there's some timing there too, isn't there, with the pollen?
Well, pollen's only going to be viable for a certain length of time.
Right.
So then you look at it, that's one thing, and then the other thing is obviously the proximity, which the isolation distances are dealing with. They have to be flowering at the same time, and you have to have compatibility. So there are, and the compatibility is not 100% with these species. So, again, you'd expect a lower level of pollination anyway, and then with all the other sort of biological requirements that there would be, you would expect that that risk would be fairly low.
So if we had an early canola crop, and then the other variety, the seed varieties, we let them head out later in the season, would that could eliminate some of the pollination problems, correct?
Well, that would help, but I think that's a pretty, and I guess I should let some of the brassica seed production people and the canola people answer that, but some of the canola varieties would be indeterminate. You get bloom for quite an extended period of time, and that I know that they plant some of the brassica species at multiple times during the year, so that is probably a fairly extended period of time for bloom there too.
Okay, and then I know canola seeds a lot. Like, I think you need to tell us how big the seed is.
I should have brought you some. It's very tiny. It's tiny, but it is very similar to the other brassica seed.
Right, right, and since of the oil base, it lasts a long time in the soil. So it's like when I work up a field at the mustard always pops up. Now, I know the mustard didn't blow in last week. It's been sitting in the ground for a long time. And do we have that problem with canola, too?
There's a certain amount of that problem with canola in that we know that it does build up seed banks. It's different than some of the especially weedy mustards, which would tend to have a longer seed life just because they're weeds versus a crop, and we try to breed those things out of crops. But we do know from our research that we were seeing volunteers coming up 2 years later in these fields, and I would expect that we would see in some fields even beyond that. Again, it will go back quite a bit to grower practices, and we were encouraging growers to not till it under, but to let it germinate and be able to spray it out, which is probably the best practice.
And the last one, Mr. Chair, what is your reason for the limited season so you can't grow it year after year?
Oh, the reason that's in the, right. That's for disease.
For disease.
So again, and other pests, but mostly for disease. So there's a, and that's pretty standard practice that you would not want to follow a brassica with a brassica.
Okay. I'm done.
So you looked at the rule the ODA has put out, and I guess my concern is, what I'm hearing is that's a much stronger standard than any of these other brassicas, because some of these brassicas we have no control, we aren't controlling at all. Is that what I'm hearing?
Senator Roman, that is correct. Some of the radishes are being pinned in the Willamette Valley Special Seed pinning system. I'm not aware if that's 100%, and I also don't know what's being pinned as far as the turnip, the purple top turnip. And even if they are being pinned, we still have no idea how many acres that actually is.
And are either of those good rotational crops for our grass seeds?
I'm not sure that I could answer that specifically, what the market will bear for those seeds. So I can't answer that.
Okay. Okay.
Chair Roblin, as far as from a biological standpoint,
yes,
they would be equivalent to the canola?
Yeah, not taking the market out, just biologically.
Yeah, biologically.
Biologically, they would. So, I mean, and there doesn't seem to be any concern that we could put, 100,000 acres of radish in the valley to cover, be a seed plant for the, it's, or some of these others, turnip, wherever the grass seed is growing, use that for a rotational crop, and there doesn't seem to be anybody uptight about that right now. It's just because it's not being used, I guess. I don't know. I just look at all these.
I can't answer if anybody's uptight about
that.
It or not.
I'm just kind of. I'm trying to figure out why canola raises such an alarm that all of these other brassicas that we're raising out there, some of which we don't pin and are just all over the place, are out there doing the same things that these others would do, and we've got mustard all over because you can see it wherever anything, any ditch or whatever, you're going to see mustard stuff. How are they offering the same problems with disease and the same problems with cross-pollination and the same problems with some of these other issues that canola has?
The brassicas would have the same issue. The turnip would have the same issue with hybridization with some of the other brassica specialty seed. The radish would not have the same hybridization issues, but the same pests and disease issues, yes.
Okay.
Chair Roblin, speculating here in with those two crops, they're seen as seed crops. So they have actually tried to bring those growers, as they found those fields, into the Specialty Seed Association. And I've been told that they've had a high success rate in doing that, but I have no way to verify that. But they're viewing those as a seed crop that would come under the same level of control that is in place for other seed crops, even though you potentially could have fairly large acreages. And so in part, I think the view is that the canola is an oilseed crop. Over all the discussions we've had, there's always been the thought that because it's an oilseed crop and potentially has lower value, that there will be less attention paid to the crop, and that lack of attention is in part what could potentially cause problems. But I think that's one of the distinctions that they're making at this point.
So you were saying that diversity is a big part of the Willamette Valley, and we know that seed crops were not a big issue in Willamette Valley 20 years ago. It was other kinds of things that we've had. So things change, markets change, and so on. Who controls? It's not the state that controls the pinning process, so it's individual, a separate group. If they pinned canola, would that be helpful in trying to figure out where things were going? I mean, I don't understand why you wouldn't want to know where all the other things are in the valley to prevent these kinds of problems, especially if pinning works.
Terrible. I would agree with you.
Okay. Yes.
I think that the difference those other crops they're using for a rotational crop, you said they're using them for a cover crop, correct?
For some of them.
It's shipped from the area and sold as cover crops in other parts of the nation or world.
Oh, the seed
it's
from
seed.
It.
The seed.
Because a cover crop, you're just plowing right. back right. under.
No, no, it's seed.
Yeah. It's seed.
All right.
Okay. Right.
Okay. With the, and I, this is not a fair question to the two of you just because you're scientists and this is what you do, but if we have a rule that expands to 2,500 acres or whatever the rule is, would it be informative to continue to have research going on this as it's moving forward, if it moves forward?
Well, Chair Roblum, of course we're going to say yes.
it was that kind of question, I know.
No, I think that it would need, though, I think there are things that we can do with monitoring and getting baseline information about what's out there right now and what happens in those first few years after canola was planted. There are a lot of things that I don't think that research is going to help with, when, especially in some of the, where we've sort of got into a lot more political water with this and the science end of it. But I think if it goes forward, it would be very prudent to do monitoring of what's going on around those, not only those fields, but other brassica seed fields, to really affirm the claims that are being made about how they're treated differently than what canola would be treated by the farmers.
And so one of the things you're saying is, and even if we don't do this brassica, it would, you're saying we don't know how much brassica we really have out in there, in the Willamette right now. Is that correct?
I don't know how much is out there. Somebody may, but I don't.
Okay. Interesting. Other questions? Yes.
Might as well.
Okay.
So with my background and the research I've done, I've kind of come to the conclusion that if the horse did get out of the barn, we did have an issue, and we stayed away from Roundup Ready canola, we could probably get a handle on it fairly quickly. Would that be a safe statement?
Chair Roblin, Senator Roger, that's really difficult to answer. I think that that comes to this zero risk and the risk that people are really sort of willing to take or not. I don't know that it's a fair statement to say, yes, we could, you know, that if it went too far down the road that we could just absolutely step back to where we were or where we are today.
But I guess we could eradicate it, though. I mean, it wouldn't be an impossibility to, if we wound up seeing it in our bar ditches and it's showing up here and there, we have the ability to get rid of it.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
Interesting. Any other questions?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, basically what I just heard is we can nuke our way out of it, not say nuke
yeah, that's right.
But we could somehow overwhelm it. But here's the part that I find very interesting and understand disclaimers. Both of you have said your statements today aren't necessarily reflective of your other colleagues or even between each right. of you. But I've heard both of you say that there's risk here, and we don't know how big of a risk it is. Is that a fair statement?
So, Chair Roblum and Senator Prozanski, I think my statement was not that, my statement is that there is not anything really that we could do in a system that would present no risk. Any new technology, any new crop that we would bring in could have, you know, unintended consequences. So it's that managing the risk at a level that you think is acceptable.
Chair Roblin, yes. Senator Prozanski, I guess I would go back to the experimental fields that we had out under the previous research that was done. So we had 9 fields out, and as best we can tell, those fields have not become major problems. We did, as Dr. Mallory Smith had indicated, we did see volunteer. But in the rotations that those growers followed, where they went back into grasses and grains, they were able to control that volunteer. So the fields themselves, again, we're back to this issue of how much scatter do you get outside the field? Do you get movement into waterways? Because those are things that are not beyond the control of the growers, but where you have more greater problems. So I think some of our experience would suggest that, provided, you know, we don't know how too far is, but provided you don't go too far, both the recent experience and then going back to the commercial production that was present in the early 1990s, again, we haven't documented at this point that there were significant problems from those fields.
So since 1990, since that work was being done, we've had the specialty crop industry that has, I guess I'm going to say, has proliferated, correct? So now we've got another, let's say, slate to be looking at. Another concern is what I've heard is ensuring diversity in our crops, and we should do that. Understand that we're trying to kumbaya and have everyone happy, but we're not going to today or on this issue. But when I read the article that was in the Oregon's Agricultural Progress, and where it says caution, the researchers conclude, is still the watchword. This study provides strong evidence that it is would be very difficult to prevent the introduction of transgenic canola into an area, even if there were provisions to only allow conventional canola production in the Willamette Valley. So maybe I'm a little more cautious, but it seems to me, why are we going to take the risk if there's other options to be rotational type crops that aren't going to pose the same potential threat?
Well, Chair Roblin and Senator Posansky, I'm not sure that we have those other rotational crops. Yes, we talked about these crops that would have the same would be the same or similar biologically to canola, but you have to have that market. And so the market for those particular seed crops is a seed market, where with canola, it's a commodity market. Commodity, you're going to get paid for that. It's going to be cash. You don't have to have a contract to sell that. So in that case, that's a they're very different. Biologically, they can be very different, but the sales of them are very similar, but the sales of them would be very different. The end uses of them are very different. And I'm not sure in that article, because I didn't write that article.
But it has your quotes around your statement, but I assume that sometimes could be misinterpreted.
Right. So the issue of the transgenics, we have varieties that are not transgenic. I mean, that's obvious. And as I stated before, right now we probably don't have many that would actually be very well adapted for growth in the Willamette Valley. Doesn't mean they wouldn't be here next year or 2 years from now or sometime, but right now that really isn't the issue. Although that's, you know, that transgenics are not addressed in the rule at all.
If I can follow up. So prior to, let's say, the desire to bring canola into the Willamette Valley, understanding it's here once before 30, 40 years ago, what have our growers, I assume the seed growers, been using as a rotational crop during this period of time that they're, I assume, for the vast majority, are continuing to use today since they're not using canola?
Chair Roblin and Senator Prozanski. So the other rotational crops that are, well, historically the other tool that we had in the valley in grass seed was field burning. And field burning did provide some level of sanitation for grassy weed seed in grass crops. And with field burning essentially gone for many parts of the valley, then you've got you've got to deal with those grassy weeds in other ways. The other rotation crops that are out there, as we'd mentioned, the legume crops are a possible rotation. There's about 40,000 acres of legumes, a mixture of clovers and peas at this point. But again, those are seed crops, and the next 5,000. This morning we had a conversation about that, and some of the clovers are at $1 a pound at this point in time. But the next 5,000 acres of red clover could take that price down because you don't have the depth of market that you have in a commodity crop like canola. Meadowfoam is another crop that's out there. We could potentially, if we could figure out how to help those growers expand some of their markets, if we could figure out how to add value to the meal they get from meadowfoam seed, there's potential that you could expand that acreage to maybe double what it is now. So there are other crops like that. Flax was, we've cycled through flax every 10 years or so the last several decades. The most recent experience was this last year with a company that we thought finally play the trick in that they actually had well-established markets and were in need of production. But as we got into some of the details of the specific varieties that they were using, they didn't work in the environment here. But that's one of the crops where perhaps we could look at locally adapted flax varieties. And if we're looking at their flax seed is much higher value at this point than canola or some of the other oil seeds. And we potentially could develop a local flax market. Both for, at this point, the edible oil and possibly fiber as well.
Yeah.
But those are the things we'd need to explore.
So the same problems as canola with regard to other kinds of stuff? Okay, that's good to know. Okay.
Metal foam, I understand. Is that considered a commodity crop?
No.
Okay. Barley?
Barley would be a grass crop again, so you'd have some of the same issues that you have with wheat in that you've got a grass crop following within that grass grain mix.
Okay. So I have to ask this just because I have a committee member that asks it from time to time. What about industrial hemp?
That was my next one.
Oh, okay.
Chair Roblin and Senator Prezansky, let me...
I didn't want you to have to ask it every time.
Oh, no, I was all right.
So Oregon, actually, if you go back to the 1930s, we were one of the research leaders in hemp. There was an ARS, Ag Research Service project here that did some of the initial breeding work with hemp. And if you go back and look at the work that they did, they eventually moved that program back to Wisconsin, and it was our climate is that hemp is the most equivalent crop would be sweet corn or silage corns in the valley. And so you've got a crop that needs warmer temperatures and needs summer rainfall. You have to have over half of the moisture that it needs coming in the summer. Sure. And so the ability where we're after dry land production with the grasses and grain rotation, you'd need supplemental irrigation, as best we can tell at this point, unless there are new varieties, in order to grow the crop. If you look at hemp production in Canada, it's in their summer-fed rainfall areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I could talk about agriculture all day.
I love agriculture. I agree.
So
Oregonians should be able to. I mean, that's what Oregon's about. So, yes.
When they're using the red clover for a rotation crop, they just use it 1 year, so they combine the seed and then plow it in for green fertilizer. Is that what they're doing? Or are they using it for a couple years?
So, Chair Rubin and Senator Bartricker, they usually they'll plant it 1 year. They may take a red clover. They may take they'll take a silage off of it usually that year. Sometimes they'll get a crop. Then they'll take it through the next year and get their second crop. And then they usually don't take it beyond that second year because we've got some insect problems with that.
Really, with red clover?
Yeah.
So couldn't they do the same thing with alfalfa rotation crop, go a couple years and use it for haylage or
dry forage?
And I can't really answer the profitability of that. I really don't know if that, because the clover, again, clover seed has a good market. You're making a good, you know, that, again, these markets go up and down, but right now it's really good. But
hay market's not too bad either.
Yeah, the hay market's not too bad either. But so I don't know. And then I think the other thing is to step back and think about equipment. What do the people grow? You know, you can't just slide something new in on them all the time. That's the one of the
without
problems.
Without visiting
we
the John Deere dealer.
We learned that big time with flax last year, how hard it is to harvest that. So, again, I was talking with one of the growers this morning who wants to grow canola, but he actually he grows corn, and he needs a rotation crop with corn, not just with his grass seed. So it makes a real difference about what's going on their farms and in their systems. And many of these growers have been looking for rotational crops. It's not that they've just been waiting for canola or anything like that.
That's true.
But the canola doesn't put the nitrogen in the ground like a legume does, though, does it?
No, it wouldn't.
Well, for corn, a legume would be probably better.
Chair Roblin and Senator Birdsugar, the other thing is irrigation again.
Yeah.
So the clovers, all of the clovers are cool season, tend to be cool season crops. There are some exceptions, and so you can grow those on the winter rainfall and don't need maybe supplemental irrigation, but they can be grown without irrigation. Dryland alfalfa, most of its growth is during the summer months, and you'd have to have water in order for those for that crop to be economically feasible in the Willamette Valley.
I think I only have one more.
Okay. It's maybe the last question, we'll see.
So I had the experience of bringing millet, barnyard millet, and dock onto the place through feed purchased from somewhere else. But we were able to get a handle on it. It took a while. And you just had to catch it before it seeded out. And it did take a few years, so that's why I brought up the issue. If we do have a problem, can we eradicate it? And it just takes a little elbow grease, but eventually get it done. Would that be a good statement?
Yes. I think it is. I think that doesn't address some of the other issues that we're talking about with hybridization and issues like that. But I don't see controlling canola as the big issue here.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Nope.
I want to thank you very much. I mean, one of the things I'm hoping personally out of this is as we work on our oceans, as we work in these other places, that we invite more research and science and that we actually spend as a state more research and science dollars so that we can have more informed decisions. And sometimes it only makes it harder because there is no definitive answer. But the more we know, the better chance we have of making decisions that will last longer, at least, if not prove out to be the right thing. So thank you very much for being here and taking your time. We appreciate it a lot.
Thank you.
So we're going to close our public informational hearing on research on the canola from OSU. And I thank you. And I don't think we have anything else, though we will have a busy day on Thursday because we have a group of bills we're going to work through. And then we have what's the other one? Okay, and a couple of public hearings. So with that, if I hear nothing else, we will end our meeting of the Senate Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development.
You'll get it before the end of the session.
I will.